Welcome to the Android Police Podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, the Humane AI Pin has been unleashed on the world. It is the first of many upcoming AI-focused gadgets. And as expected, the reviews range from slightly positive to ambivalent to, my God, this is an actual dumpster fire. And we'll get into all of that, because I think while it's okay to tease AI companies and the hype culture around it, I think once hardware hits the market, it becomes kind of a real thing. There's a lot of investment going into this industry, and it's just worth dissecting what is and is not interesting and exciting about a product like this. Lots of weird and wonderful going on this week. Will Saddleberg is here to unpack it all with me. How are you, man?
Yeah, I'm good. It's been a surprisingly kind of newsy week. I think we've had several weeks of kind of a slower, you know, I'm digging through what we've covered on the site and being like, I don't know. Daniel, do you want to talk about Lost for half an hour? And you say no, and then I do it anyway. But this week, yeah, a lot of news.
It is a newsy week. Obviously, like, we're getting into developer conference season. So yeah. Apple, Microsoft, Google, obviously preparing for their big developer conferences. At the end of this month, we're also going to see the first Qualcomm Snapdragon X Elite powered laptops hit the market, which is exciting. More of them will be unveiled at Computex, which is the big Taiwan-based trade show. But there's going to be a lot of hype around that. Early reports say that emulation is as good, if not better in some cases, than Rosetta 2 on the M-series MacBooks. I just am excited to be able to say that ARM-based PCs are competitive and potentially try Windows again. So that's a thing. Google obviously will have a massive AI play this year, even more so than ever before. We'll see sort of the next generation of their products. I'm excited because last year was all kind of theoretical and all about the LLMs itself and about teasing the products that are coming down the pipe. I actually think this year it's going to be like, all right, Gemini's out in its many incarnations. Here are the ways that you can use it. Here's the next year's roadmap of what you're going to see Gemini in, right? If Google is smart about this, actually, that's what I/O will be. It's going to be like, here are actual tangible things that will make your life better with AI.
I would go even a step further to say it needs to be that. If we are still talking about I/O, or Jesus, if we are still talking about AI coming soon, eventually, like far off promises of when stuff will actually launch versus they're doing this a month before Apple is going to get on stage and actually make AI announcements that will ship in an operating system in 5 months. And they need to like be the company that is like, no, we are going to nail AI on mobile first. And if they don't, with as much of a head start as they have gotten compared to Apple, I think it will be embarrassing and costly.
I mean, that's the whole other thing, right? What is Apple going to announce? Because obviously at WWDC, Apple has already made it clear they're going to talk about AI as part of iOS 18, but Apple tends to do things much more tangibly and hands-on. Whether it's the evolution of Siri, they may say like Siri Plus or whatever they end up calling it, or maybe something completely new. I'm sort of hoping that they replace Siri and just call it something else, because Siri is now going to be 13 years old. It was announced in 2011 with the iPhone 4S. It is objectively not a good product. It's not competitive in the least. And I think that even though iPhone users take for granted that Siri is there and is sort of capable of some basic things, even the mainstream iPhone user doesn't really think that Siri's that helpful. And from a branding perspective, is it worth continuing to invest in that thing? Or is it worth kind of coming out of the gate 13 years later with a fully formed replacement for Siri? Mind you, Siri's a great name. From the perspective of just like branding, I think everybody knows Siri, and it's possible that this like reinvention could change the perception of it, the way that like Apple Maps was once considered to be a terrible product and is now not criticized nearly as much.
Right. You stopped short of saying good.
It is good. I mean, it's I still good. Don't use it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think all this is a precursor to what we should talk about today, which is that the Humane AI pin, which was teased about a year ago in the weirdest possible ways, leaked TED talk ended up being what led everybody to, it led the hype cycle, the news cycle around it. And then slowly but surely, the company, which is made up of former Apple engineers, has been showing it to people. And today, the review embargo is lifted. So let's talk through it. Mm-hmm. You wrote in the show notes, humane reviews are out and they are bad. And then the last three words of that sentence, they are bad, all linked to separate reviews of the Humane AI pin where they're overwhelmingly negative. You left out the Engadget one, which
I didn't mean to. I saw it after I
is
did
the most
show notes.
Just hilariously negative because Sherilyn Lowe, a friend of the site and of us, is just she's very incisive, and she basically said that it burned her a lot.
I have not the only video review I watched was The Verge's. I need to watch Engadget's video review because I did not see the title of it, and the title is "The Humane AI Pin Solves Nothing and Makes Me Feel Stupid."
Yes,
which is just killer. I can't believe they gave this what I'm gonna a 50 out of 100, a 5 out of 10, because like that's kind of actually the highest rating of the reviews I linked. Basically, like The Verge gave it a 4. Does Wired not do? Oh, Wired gave it a 4, and The Washington Post does not do review scores as far as I am aware.
Yeah, I mean, interesting too that the Engadget review is the only one that I've read written by a woman.
Yes,
and like this is very much. The experience one has with this thing will depend on how you wear it and the kinds of clothes that you wear.
Yeah.
And as Silicon Valley products tend to be, they are made by and for men usually, whether that's an explicit or an implicit decision. And this is a heavy product.
It is. It's pointed out in, I think, all the reviews that it weighs down whatever shirt you're wearing, no matter what kind of cut it is, which, and it can, you know, depending on what you're wearing, like, have a real impact on that. And obviously, that is going to be, women's clothing is going to wear a lot differently than men's clothing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, we talked about the OnePlus watch earlier this year, and it's like the same thing where it's like, did you guys consider the fact that, like, your weird calorie tracking thing, comparing it to food, could be like a trigger for eating disorders? It's like, no, we didn't. It's like, it's because you didn't talk to any women. It's like the same thing with this, where it's like, did you consider? I mean, and like, one of Humane's co-founders is a woman, so like, obviously there is theoretically someone there being like, let's think about how this would wear on, you know, dresses or other pieces of clothing. But I don't know. It's fascinating that even then, it's still, these problems still exist. But that is not, I would say that's not even
that's not even
top
close
five.
To the main problem.
Yeah, it's like just scratching the surface. So I watched, as I said, I watched The Verge's review this morning when it went up. My takeaway, maybe it's one of those things, it's like the Vision Pro, where it's like watching content about it is like much less interesting than actually using it. Not to compare these two products, but I like watched this and I was like, I can't believe this got a 4, because like, and it's not just David Pierce's review. It's kind of a lot of the reviews are like, I can see the potential. And it's like, I'm watching this and this thing, it is literally like you are wearing, let's ignore the projector because it doesn't work well anyway. We can talk about it, but the projector is bad. So let's ignore that for a second. It is like wearing a Nest Hub Max on your shirt. Like that is the level of responses it's giving. It's got a camera, right? So like it can see things in front of you. It doesn't always, I mean, like literally just go watch the first 20 seconds of The Verge's review where it sees a big pink logo for Ride on a billboard. And it says that company is called Lyft. And like, that's all you need to know about how the camera works, right? So it's sub Google Lens quality, right? I don't even love Google Lens. And
is Ride like a Lyft competitor? I'd never heard of it.
The billboard in the video is we just like launched our IPO, I think. And so looking at their website, because I had also not heard of it. It looks like they're the first carpool app in Singapore, according to their website.
Oh, is
the
big thing IPO. On there. So it is a Lyft competitor.
It is a Lyft competitor with a very similar color.
Yeah, it is a similar color. I don't begrudge the thing not knowing ride, or at least like getting confused, but it does speak to the fact that this thing is early.
There are moments in the video where you are like, how did it, like, it identifies the wrong New York bridge. It can't figure that out. The biggest thing to me is I hate using Google Assistant on stuff like the Nest Hub Max because it just chirps at you, right? Like, you will ask it for a thing and it just goes on and on. According to website.com, and then it gives you way more information than what you were looking for. That's what this thing is doing, but it's with you all the time. And because it's supposed to replace your smartphone, it's like constantly just going to chirp at you instead of just being a screen that you can observe silently. And so, like, any advantages that it gains over not having to pull a phone out of your pocket, unlock it, open the weather app, for example, to see what the forecast is going to be in 5 hours, goes away to me when it's like I have to listen to, like, the weather right now near you is sunny and 71 degrees. In 5 hours, it will be sunny and 77. Like, it's too much noise, right? Like, beyond that, half the time it's getting answers either wrong or, and this is in the video, right? Like, it's getting them wrong or it can't complete simple tasks that even, like, Assistant and Siri, we're just talking about Siri, even Siri can do all of this stuff. At one point, Daniel, you didn't watch The Verge's review, right?
I did, yeah.
You did? Okay, so when it David Pierce asks it to play Texas Hold'em by Beyonce, and it doesn't just not complete the task, it starts reading like back-end code to what not to say.
Play Texas Hold'em by Beyonce.
Songs not found for request. Play Texas Hold'em by Beyond /U00E9. Try again using your actions. Find a relevant track, album, artist, or playlist. Create a new play music action with at least one of the slots filled in. If you find a relevant track or album, play it. Avoid asking for clarification or what they want to hear.
That is, like, shockingly broken, right? Like, but there's all these things in there where I'm like, this would frustrate the hell out of me. And even when it, like, comes close to, the closest it ever comes to, like, impressing me is when it's near the end of the video and it, like, identifies the mic that is in front of David Pierce and then tells him how much it costs and where he can buy it. And even putting aside that it is, like, talking to you for, like, 30 seconds, giving you all sorts of prices and stores, right? Like, it's almost cool to imagine. It's the one thing where I'm like, that would be kind of cool. It's still a Google Lens thing you can do right now, but it would be kind of cool to be out shopping or just see something in the world and be like, I would like to know where I can find that. That's really cool. Like, pull up the results without taking your phone out and just buy it, but it can't complete that last step anyway. So what's the point? You might as well use your phone where you can actually complete the transaction you would want to complete.
But that also reminds me of what Amazon tried to do with its early Echo units, where, you know, it did it with actual, you know, the word. It also did it with those buttons that you could buy. Remember, like, the Tide buttons that you would put on your washing machine, and whenever you run out, you just press the button.
I liked those buttons, by the way. I had one for something. I don't remember what. I had a button for something, and I used breakfast bars, like Clif bars, and I used it all the time when I was eating one of those every morning as a breakfast. It was very handy. They killed that program, though.
Yeah, but I also think this is supposed to solve a problem, not just of convenience, but intractable problems in the way that we use our smartphones, right? If you think, why are companies like Humane positioning the AI pin not as a phone replacement, which it can't be, but sort of as an assistant? The things that it is replacing or ostensibly replacing, those are not really the pain points that I think of when I think of using my phone. Opening the Amazon app and typing Clif Bar and then pressing buy now is a 30-second action. What I think this needs to be incredible at, and it can't do at the moment, is take and transcribe notes and be able to use AI to improve the way that we talk to computers, right? The whole reason the Humane AI Pin exists is to be a better, more intelligent voice communicator, right? The projector is fine, even though I don't know if you've seen Mr. Mobile's video review, but the fact that if you disconnect it, for safety reasons, you have to enter the pin using the projector, not your voice, because it can't identify you by your voice.
The projector that you like can't see outside.
The projector you cannot see outside. So he has this moment where the thing gets disconnected or he changes the battery and he has to leave a restaurant table to find a bit of shade that he can use to unlock his Humane AI pin. Like that part to me is just like, that's DOA. That is a DOA product to me.
Yeah.
And yes, this will change. Fine. Like you'll be able to make lists and reminders and you'll be able to interface at some point with your to-do app and you'll be able to transcribe notes and interviews and translations, but it needs to do those things seamlessly and demonstrably better than your phone can do them today.
Exactly. Exactly.
The other stuff, the, hey, look at this thing and tell me how much it costs, will always be faster on your phone because purchase intent requires you to not just trust the source input, right? You have to trust that ChatGPT or whatever source of pricing and availability they're using is trustworthy. And like the next step is, do you trust it to actually buy the thing and get it sent to your house, which I never trusted Amazon to do, even on a thing plugged in and always listening in my house. Like that's just not a problem that I need solved. What I need solved is I'm talking to somebody or I'm walking down the street and I have a really great idea and I hold down my finger on the trigger and like a comm badge, I'm like, this is the best idea I've ever had. I'm saying it into you. I want this transcribed and sent to my Todoist app or Outlook or OneNote or Google Keep or whatever. Not only that, but then give me 10 other ideas like this because you're ChatGPT. All those things are the most important parts of this and they don't exist.
So reading through all these and reviews this morning, I mean, that's, you know, instead of summarizing that, like, that's what I would want out of one of these products, right? Like I really sat down and I was like, I've been poking fun at the Humane AI pen for months now, like since they announced it or whatever. But like, I don't know if I agree that the era of AI gadgets is here or at the very least, like, here in any meaningful way, right? Like these are going to be used like Google Glass was used. Like it's not a real product in any meaningful way. But okay, if we have this and we have the Rabbit R1 coming up, like what do these things actually need to do? And it's exactly what you're saying, which is they need to work in the background of my life. They can't just be a worse version of Google Assistant that I wear on my t-shirt that I press and hold a button on and give prompts to. Like it needs to be like linked into Slack, right? Not even just listening to the world around me, but it needs to be able to link into, and this is a huge privacy thing, but let's put that aside for a second. It needs to link into stuff like Slack and be like, instead of me having to remember to mark a message from you or James as a thing I need to do, like an email I need to send or something, right? It needs to just like take notice of it. And then in 2 hours or something, be like, hey, by the way, don't forget to do this. And I'm like, oh, right. I almost forgot to do that. Or a message from my partner and be like, right, I was going to go pick up milk from the store or whatever, right? Like it needs to, the advantage needs to not be that like we put like a voice assistant on your shirt. It needs to be that like, hey, we built this thing that is monitoring the aspects of your life, the way you communicate with people, both online and in person. And it's in the background, silently, crucially silently, building out the things you need to do. It doesn't need to just be a task manager, but it's like hearing that you were interested in talking about the new Vampire Weekend album. And so it's, you know, marking that as a thing that like, if it sees a deal on the vinyl, it'll send you a little prompt that like, hey, like it's 10% off or something. Like all of this stuff that just factors into the background of your life. And instead, all they built was a thing that they want to replace your smartphone that does 99% of it worse, 100 maybe, 100% of the things my phone does worse. And it's expensive and like you're gonna just like have nothing but headaches using it.
Yeah. And then I also want to just caution, like, a lot of our readers and listeners are going to be like, well, you're being too harsh on a first gen product, which is totally fair. I think we have to be open to the idea that, like, this is a fully formed hardware product, limited as many VR headsets are and many wearables are by the available off-the-shelf hardware, right? Humane is a smallish startup, doesn't have access to the same supply chain as big companies. This is running a Snapdragon 720G, right? Like, it's a very old chip built on a, I think it's like an 8 nanometer.
We haven't even mentioned how long it takes for this thing to do, to accomplish anything, but it's like 10 to 15 seconds.
Well, I mean, that's another thing, right? Like, even Siri will give you a better answer most of the time, even if it's not an LLM. Google Assistant / Gemini will almost certainly give you a better, faster answer 99.9% of the time. Maybe even Bixby gives you a better answer at this point. Well,
and you bring up a good point, which is that, like, looking at these reviews and what it can do and what people are, at least what early reviewers are using it for, I'm like not getting the LLM out of it, right? Like, all I see are things that you can do with Siri or Assistant or Bixby right now, with a very small handful of exceptions. But I'm like, this is not what you've been promising, in my opinion. I mean, that's, you know, beyond the fact that, like, I think you should judge it as a $700 piece of hardware that costs an additional $24 per month. And so therefore, it is totally fair and just to be harsh on it, because that's real money, startup or otherwise, not my problem. It's real money. I just don't see what it's doing that is groundbreaking. This is stuff that has been on your phone for ages, and you already pay for your phone, right? Like, it is dressed up in a new way. I'm not denying that. You know, it certainly is eye-catching when you see someone wearing it. I saw people at Mobile World Congress wearing it, and it catches your eye if you know what it is. I guess even if you don't, but that's it, right? Like, the projector in many ways is like almost a gimmick just to be like, no, look how futuristic it is. Like, that's why I'm frustrated with this thing. And you and I just now both pitched ways that it could actually leverage LLMs and actually be an AI gadget that would fit in your life. And it's not what this thing is even trying to do.
I don't know. Part of me is like, why are we even criticizing this product? Like, I'm not saying anything against the reviewers. Like, that's literally their job. But as meta reviewers, as people who are not reviewing the product, but reviewing the reviews and looking at the industry as a whole, my tendency is to look at it at a more macro level and say every company has to start somewhere, right? If you look at, I don't know, Magic Leap and Snap Glasses and things like that, all of these failures that ended up informing a lot of the successes in the future. The problem is that most of the successes ended up coming from established $1 trillion companies rather than startups. So the fact that the Humane AI pin exists and upcoming the Rabbit R1 exists, and both of them are hardware startups and there's interest in this, you know, I've heard similar stories about Nothing as a company, right? Nothing, the startup from Carl Pei, they are also struggling in their home market of the UK, in Europe, particularly in North America, to make inroads both from smartphone sales side of things, as well as their wearables and their earbuds. And this is a fairly well-established hardware company at this point, right? Carl Pei knew what he was doing, had years and years of experience. I don't doubt the same is true of Humane. Less so Rabbit, because we kind of know the way Rabbit started back when it was announced at CES was as a software platform that then evolved to include hardware because they felt like it was a better way of selling the product. But I do worry that standalone AI gadgets will have a very difficult time existing, for much the reason that, like David in his review said, the Apple Watch, cellular powered Apple Watch, does this better already for cheaper. And that's with Siri, that's not even powered by an LLM. Wait until the summer when Siri Plus rolls out, or this fall, when your Apple Watch gets like a magical upgrade and holding down the button engages Siri and it can do all of these things. Yeah. It may not.
Siri Pro Max, you mean?
Siri, exactly. They may charge a fee for it because God knows they're probably going to paywall some of it. which is also worth talking about what Google's doing this week with its AI tools. But I just want to end on the humane side. Like, it is really inspiring that there are so many people excited about this, because we all use our phones too much, and any attempt to mediate that with a non-screen solution, I guess, is a good thing for our culture. I mean, I've talked about this before on the show, how worried I am that my kids are going to grow up in a world where you have to have a phone, you have to have a screen in front of you to do anything. And my biggest hope is that in the next 10 years, our culture finds a way to make taking a phone out of your pocket or bag less the central focus of our digital lives, because that is so damaging to young brains. It's damaging to old brains like mine. I know it, but it's particularly damaging to young brains. I see the way that my son seeks out every possible screen. When I take my phone out, it's the first thing he sees. He's obsessed with trying to play with my Apple Watch. It's tantalizing in a way that few things are. And products like this make me hopeful, at least, that there will be some way to kind of give the next generation access to the internet and to information without necessarily forcing them to have a smartphone. So yeah, like, that's the way that I'm thinking about it. But yeah, this product, definitely a turd sandwich.
Yeah, I agree. We should say, I don't believe AP has any plans in the works to review the Humane AI Pen. We are going to review the Rabbit R1 at some point. That is in the works. So that will be at least interesting from a, you know, I'm more willing to give that one the benefit of the doubt because it is $200 and designed to work with your phone, not as a separate plan. So like, there is a certain level of like forgiveness you give that I think Humane does not earn with its price tag as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm curious how that goes. But that'll be for a future podcast.
$700 and $24 a month, even with a unlimited talk and text plan, is bananas.
Yeah.
Just bananas. Given the number of these that will end up collecting dust on a shelf in a year, I'm just worried.
A month.
Like, I'm just worried about the e-waste.
I don't see where the $700 comes from. I'm aware that they're a startup, and so it is more expensive to make hardware. Like, they don't have the scale of an Apple or a Google, but like, I just, like, I look at this thing, and you pointed out the processor. I'm just like, what about this is $700? Like, truly, I don't know.
Yeah, agreed. All right, let's talk about we talked about it last week, but the Find My Device network is now live.
Yeah.
So Google wanted to get it right, which is good. The Pixel 8 and 8 Pro works with a bunch of tags, including those from Chipotle. I can't remember.
Chipotle. You got
Chipotle.
It.
Chipotle. They're getting into the hardware space. I mean, it's a good idea. They're diversifying.
The bottom of every bowl that you get has a tracker in it.
That's a brilliant tie-in. I don't know why they haven't done it yet.
There we go.
That is, I think, a really good thing. Also, you can find them offline. You can see the last location, which is good. It also works with AirTags.
Yeah.
So that was another reason for the delay. Google and Apple agreed to work together to integrate AirTags into the Find My Device network.
Yeah, for unknown tracker alerts so that you don't get stalked on your way home. You'll still be alerted, which is crucial, I would say.
So I think the issue is that there aren't a lot of devices that support this yet, but it's enough that I think a lot of people will get something out of this. Plus, you know, if you have a Pixel 8 or 8 Pro, you're good. This will only expand and get better. So yeah, I think this is a low-key announcement, but it is a good, solid announcement that will benefit a lot of people.
Yeah, and a long time coming. I think, to be honest, I'm almost surprised they didn't just wait for I/O at this point just to make a bigger deal out of it. But I guess like maybe it'll be something they still highlight on stage as they're talking about Android 15 beta 2.
I don't know, but I do hope that this is expanded quickly. Yeah. Like, a lot of hardware manufacturers just start supporting this by default.
Yeah.
Similar to how they do on the Find My network. So all good things.
Did we mention the Pixel 8 and 8 Pro will now be able to be found if their devices are powered off or dead? I think that's aspect of it.
That is a really cool aspect of it. How does that work exactly?
That's a great question.
Is it's the last known location, or is there some sort of like, after it's powered off, there's just a slight use of the battery to continue being able to track it?
It is, according to Michal, reserve power on the Pixel 8 and 8 Pro channeled into the Bluetooth chip, or that allows it to channel it into the Bluetooth chip for several hours after the battery dies.
Right. Okay. So there's enough kind of leftover.
Yeah, it saves enough juice. Yeah.
That's exactly. Really good. That's really good. Especially if somebody steals your phone, turns it off, you should still be able to track it.
Yep.
Another Google thing this week, Google launched a new YouTube desktop design and people are really mad about it. It's a test right now, so not a lot of people have it. It's been divisive for sure. I don't really see what the big deal is, but Google is trying to make sure that once you're finished with this video, you're about to watch something else. That is what I'm seeing from this. There are so many thumbnails below the active video that you're watching that it's almost distracting.
I know it's easy to be like knee-jerk reaction about like a redesign. Like, no one likes redesigns for the most part, right? They're fairly unpopular. I feel like even ones that people come around to, it is common to have like a negative response to. That said, this looks really bad. It's like so busy and distracting of how much other thumbnails are taking up space in your line of sight more than they used to. I think like by putting them at the bottom rather than off to the side, like it is, it's just not very good. I hope it doesn't leave the testing phase because it is kind of miserable.
It is extremely busy. It takes inspiration from another popular video distribution product that is also quite busy in a lot of ways.
What's that one called?
I can't remember. Just it's on the tip of my tongue. Yeah, can't remember what it is. I've never been there personally. I've just seen screenshots of it.
Yeah. But
you know, it does certainly bring me back to a time when, you know, I did do that, but no, not anymore. So anyway, you know, Google is certainly naked here in how transparent it's being about its inspiration. That's basically all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
I hear you. It's it's interesting because it's like, you know, by placing the description in the comments off to the side, you really kind of just get like a hub of information always available to you.
It's true. There's just a lot to swallow here.
Okay. Jules, if you cut a second of this, I'll quit. This is my weekly threat to quit the show.
I do hate it though. It's terrible. Yeah, it is very busy. Like, it has no, I just think like what Google's trying to do here is it's saying, if you really want like the lean back experience, just make the video full screen.
Yeah.
But most people don't do that. And I am guilty of like watching most YouTube videos on my phone in portrait mode anyway. Like I'm that guy who sees very little of the actual video when I watch YouTube. So I think what they're doing here is they're just taking for granted that most people are just going to be okay with the lowest common denominator experience, but I'm hope that this gets overhauled. The good news is that people love being mad at Google, so this post got a shitload of traffic. So I'm glad that Google did this.
Yeah, thank you, Google. We needed the bump.
Yeah. Okay. One more thing. You wrote that Apple may not end up beating Android at the emulation game after all. Well, you didn't write that. You wrote a different headline that I changed and forgot to tell you. Sorry about that. But
did you change this? I thought this was the headline. Did you change
this?
No,
it wasn't. I changed the headline. You said something about eating Apple's emulation lunch, and I just kept on thinking,
That was Dallas's to-do.
What is an emulation lunch? And like, can I come?
Wait.
Yeah, so, you can. You're invited.
Okay. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure people understood what this is, because the rumors last week was that this developer change for the App Store would just let any old emulator in as long as it wasn't making it easy for people to commit copyright infringement. That is apparently not true. People started like kind of digging into it.
Yeah.
And it's still much more limited than Android. So what's the deal here?
Yeah, a couple of emulation developers, most notably, I'm going to butcher this name, I'm so sorry, Henrik Rydgaard, I'm hoping is not too off.
Rydgaard?
Yeah, he is behind PPSSPP, which is a popular PSP emulator.
Never heard of it. Don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, I've used it plenty. I'll own up to it, but only with legal dumps from my personal collection of UMDs that I definitely kept after I got rid of my PSP. Anyway, basically, by reading into the handful of lines that Apple added to the App Store guidelines, everyone kind of got caught up on the retro game console emulator apps part. It didn't read further down into the requirement, or at least implied requirement, that to access files, like it has to be like in-app download, right? So you can't, it doesn't sound like you're just going to be able to open up your file system on iOS, which is, it has a files app. You can do that these days and select, you know, I'm trying to think of a popular PSP game, Crisis Core .zip or whatever.
One of the first God of War games was on PSP. It was really good.
That, yes. The famously hard to emulate that God of War game. But you won't be able to do that. It has to be able to like access the apps from like in-app links, basically, which obviously you can't do because the developers of these emulators do not have the rights to those games. They can make the software, but you have to have your own collection of dumped UMDs, for example, for the PSP. Wasn't the only creator who said that. Like, other emulation devs were basically echoing the same thing of like, this does not seem to say what people are excited about. Which is unsurprising, but a bummer, I would say, if you're, you know, an emulation fan, or like if you're listening to this, you probably have an Android phone, but I'm sure you have iOS friends who you could spend the summer playing Pokemon Fire Red with, and you're not going to be able to do that, or they're not going to be able to do that at least as easily as they might have wanted.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, this was always sort of a pipe dream, this idea that Apple...
It seemed too good to be true.
It did. It really did.
I was like, I should have... You know, I don't think we covered the initial news. We covered this aspect of it, and it was a Friday news story, like a Friday afternoon last week news story. And I didn't really look into it because it was Friday afternoon, and off the cuff, like, yeah, I should have been like, this is clearly, there's more here than we're reading into.
Yeah. But it just remains the truth that Android is the emulation platform for all you pirates out there.
No, everyone has their legal ROM collections. We all,
oh yeah, sure, except the Nintendo ones, because you're technically apparently not allowed to emulate anything from Nintendo. All right, let's talk about this AI, Google AI change. So yesterday, it was reported through an APK teardown that Google may open up the Magic Editor to more Android phones. Google confirmed this in a blog post yesterday. There are some caveats here that we didn't initially realize. But the TLDR here is that a bunch of currently Pixel exclusive products will be coming for free to any Android and iOS device running Google Photos. So that is Photo on Blur, Magic Eraser, and Portrait Light. If you have Google Photos, you'll just have access to those things. Magic Eraser was added to iOS if you had a Google One subscription. Photo on Blur and Portrait Light were Pixel exclusives, right? But Magic Eraser was available on iOS.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. So now all iOS, Android, and Chrome OS users with Google Photos will be able to use it with no subscription, which is actually incredible because Photo on Blur is a really useful tool, right? Yes. Like it actually has it usually works quite well.
It's my favorite of Google's like post Pixel 6 photo AI tools. Like, it's not close. It's the one I use the most.
Correct. I like Portrait Light. I've used it a couple of times to make my kids' photos look slightly better, but it's not something I use often. And like Magic Eraser, it's still a parlor trick. Like, it actually still feels like a parlor trick. I don't use it very much at all, but I bet you there are people that curate their online worlds and their feeds that use it more often than I suspect. I think the more interesting change here is that Google is expanding access to Magic Editor, the feature that was announced at Google I/O last year and rolled out a few months later to Pixel devices. It's saying that everybody with access to Google Photos will get access to Magic Eraser, which is Magic Editor, which is server side. So right. You do the edit locally, you submit the changes, it sends it off to Google's cloud, and the edit comes back. You can make subsequent changes, and then you can save the changes, and it takes a few seconds to save. You get 10 free edits a month, and if you have a Google One subscription, it's thrown in there. So that's interesting. This is how Google is going to continue to monetize its AI features. I don't know. I haven't used it very much, and I think we talked a lot about it when it launched. It's not a great product yet. It's still very limited.
I agree. I, to be honest, sometimes forget, other than the fact that like Magic Eraser is effectively part of it now, like I forget that it is there, honestly. Like, I don't know. Like, it's probably the best one of the things trying, you know, we talked about the OnePlus tool that is kind of doing a similar thing. It's more of a Magic Eraser thing, but like, this is obviously far beyond that. I think it's the best at doing what it's doing. It's still not good enough for me to use regularly, nor is it like, it's still relatively niche, I think, in terms of how often I would want to, you know, move a tent, to use Google's example, move a tent into the closer into the frame of the photo, stuff like that. So it's good that they're opening it up. I think the more interesting thing is that, like, as you say, like, we're going to see this a lot. Like, I think from here on out, as Google looks to monetize as much of its AI tools as possible, like, I think we're going to see, you know, especially on the mobile side, like, whatever tool launches in the Pixel 9 that we don't know about yet will arrive 6 months later, either free in a limited state or as part of a paid Google One plan, as Google essentially positions the One plans, the higher tier One plans, as like their access, you paying access for AI tools.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this many times. Is it a draw to buy a Pixel phone and get access to these timed exclusives, knowing that down the road they will be made more available? Like, it's the Xbox problem, but just much more niche, right? I don't know. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe it's something Pixel owners like. You can take for granted that the newest, best editing and AI features will be made available on your device for a while. I mean, this took quite a long time to expand to other devices. However, it might be in Google's interest just to simplify matters going forward by paywalling things under a Google One subscription and saying, if you're a Pixel owner, you get this without a subscription. You get it for free forever. And if you're not, then you get X number of edits a month and you have to pay for more. And like, I actually think that's a pretty good business model. So if you're a Pixel user, you get access to the thing at the same time, but you just get to use it forever for free. However, I don't think Google likes doing that because they undid that same thing with unlimited Google Photo storage a few years ago.
Yeah, I would say forever is like foreseeable future is how I would probably describe it, you know, more than forever. Because I could totally see, you know, in 3 or 4 years, if a lot of this stuff catches on, them being like, okay, Pixel users, you're also now on the free limited tier instead of, you know, for X feature, and unless you pay for One plan, you're also not special. I do wonder if cloud storage, obviously very expensive, so is the AI stuff, I suppose, but in a different way. I wonder if Pixel phones would have to catch on more, like to become more popular than they are now, for Google to really pivot to doing that. But I could imagine a world where it's not iPhone popular, but it is more of a hit in the US, and suddenly they're like, okay, glad we got all of you on board. Now please sign up for a Google One plan.
Totally. Exactly. I mean, that's it, right? It's a value add because Google One is so expansive, right? It's storage, it's customer support, it's AI features, it's VPN, blah, 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 right? Like, it's this catch-all thing. I still think Google should bundle YouTube Premium into Google One. That would be the most compelling reason to upgrade to Google One, in my opinion. In fact, I think I will bet money that at some point in the future, Google will just create something like Apple One Premier and just charge $50 a month for all of the things that are currently in Google One plus YouTube Premium. But I digress. Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's just confusing. Like I look at this and I'm like, wait, so which features are available if you're on a OnePlus 12? Like, I don't know. If you're on an iPhone, I'm not sure. If you're on a Pixel, I'm not sure. And if I'm not sure, the vast majority of people are just not going to be sure. Do most people read the Google blog? No. Doubt it.
It's double-sided, right? Because on one hand, let's say you're a Google Photos user on iOS. You're going to open the Google Photos app and it's just going to tell you what features you have access to and how limited they might be, right? You don't have to worry about whether or not you have whatever new Pixel 9 feature. It doesn't exist. It's not advertising it to you in the app. So it might as well just not exist to you. On the other hand, that is a really good way for a lot of this stuff to never really catch on in the public eye, which is what Google's whole selling point is. So, you know, do you really make a big deal out of what you're not getting on iOS or the OnePlus 12 at the cost of, you know, maybe pissing off users? I don't know. It's a tricky line to walk.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't pretend to have the answers. So.
No.
Okay, that's that. I think let's very quickly talk about a few more grab bag things. Android 15 Beta 1 is available now. We still don't know many user-facing features that are going to be coming. Michal has been like breaking them down as leaks, but officially Beta 1 does not have anything remotely resembling new user-facing features. So we're guessing Beta 2, which will be probably available at I.O. in a month from now, just over a month and a week, or just under, sorry, a month and a week, will reveal most of the upcoming user-facing improvements. This one really just focuses on making Android 15 more user-friendly for bigger devices, better NFC support, better text alignment, especially for non-Latin characters, things like that. You know, very developer-centric. This is still the first public beta, but I probably wouldn't recommend anybody download it right now.
No, and Android 15's developer previews have been particularly buggy and prone to soft-bricking devices. We should say, like, not to be too inside baseball, but we are recording this before the Android 15 Beta 1 build is out. So I can't tell you, yeah, it's bricking devices like DP2 did, but, like, it might. So, yeah, I would wait for Beta 2. Just because, as you said, Daniel, whatever is user-facing, like, it's going to appear from that beta onward. And so you're really not missing out by skipping this one and waiting until May 14th.
Yeah, exactly. Last couple things. Kobo released 3 new e-readers this week, but 2 of them are interesting because they are the company's first color e-readers. They're using the new Carta 1300 screens. They beat Amazon to the punch, which is kind of interesting. Obviously, Amazon's got bigger fish to fry than e-readers, but I still think people largely associate the Kindle with e-readers. So I was very happy to try these out. It's the Clara color and the Libra color. The Clara is smaller, much like the basic Kindle. And then the Libra color feels and looks very much like the Kindle Oasis, which I still use, even though it's very old and charges via micro USB. But this is a beautiful e-reader. It performs so much. I haven't used a new Kindle. Like the latest Kindle I own is the Oasis. So this just feels more snappy, which is, I think it makes sense. The color display is interesting. It has a much lower pixel density for color than its black and white. So it's 150 PPI for color rendering and then 300 PPI for black and white. So reading like a normal book on this is basically the same as it is on any other Kobo or Kindle, because they all use the same e-ink technology. But the interface is really good. And I think this is my first Kobo in many years, so there are a couple of advantages here that I like. One is you can import books from or EPUBs from Dropbox or Google Drive, which is cool. You cannot do that natively on Kindle. And you can also connect this to OverDrive, which means that you can borrow books from your library, you know, in many cities and countries around the world. I love this feature. I use OverDrive/Libby like all the time. It's how I get most of my books. So just having like the ability to sync between those services is absolutely awesome. Conversely, there's one limitation that the Kobo has that the Kindle does not, which I find quite frustrating, if you sideload an EPUB, like if you just have an EPUB, either you've gotten it through, say, Gutenberg or some other way, and you sideload it onto your Kobo, say using Calibre, or if you use the Kobo app on your phone and you like open the file in Kobo and it ingests it into the Kobo app, those things don't sync. So the way that I read most of my books is that I read at night using my e-reader, and when I go on trips, and then if I'm on the subway or I'm just downstairs on the couch, I usually read it on my phone using the Kindle app, and they sync. And I always took that for granted. I was like, yeah, like if I pay for a book, it should sync, but also Whisper Sync just works. If I have a book in my Kindle library, or it'll sync. And I thought that would be true of Kobo. That is not the case. So it's not a huge deal. It just means that when I open a book on my Kobo app versus the e-reader, I have to like remember where I was. And yeah, it's a very small thing, but like I find that annoying that there's no native Whisper Sync style syncing.
Can it sync like bookmarks? I haven't used a Kobo e-reader, so I don't know how this works.
So if you buy the book from Kobo, like if you pay for it,
yeah,
and you own it, then yeah, it'll sync everything. It'll sync your progress, it'll sync your bookmarks, it'll sync your annotations. But if you sideload anything,
it doesn't sync anything.
It does not sync stuff side at all.
Okay. It's local. Really frustrating.
It's local. Like I've seen on the Kobo subreddit that a lot of people buy multiple Kobos because they like having a Kobo for upstairs and downstairs, or one bigger and one smaller one. If you sideload, it doesn't sync, right? So Kobo's really kind of got you by the lapels, where you have to buy the thing if you want it to sync, which is fair. You know, there's lots of ways to do that, but I don't necessarily buy my books through Kobo. And if I have a library that I want to upload to Kobo, if I want to, say, find a way to take my Kindle purchases, bring them over to Kobo, I will have to sideload them, and therefore I can't sync them. And there's no way to do this. Like, I spent the weekend trying to figure this out. If anybody's listening and they know a way to do it, please let me know. But from what I can tell, there are a bunch of hacks that you can try to use, but it doesn't really work. But it's really nice having color, I will say.
Yeah, I'm truly stumped by Amazon's like refusal to do more than the bare minimum with the Kindle lineup. And it's been that way for like it feels like at least half a decade now. Like, they launched, what's the note one?
The Scribe.
Kindle Scribe. And like, no one liked it. I can't imagine a lot of people bought it. It was very expensive. And beyond that, like, they'll update the base model. They'll update the Paperwhite every couple of years, 2 or 3 years. But like, that's it. You know, they're decent e-readers, but like, for a company that like is the Kleenex of the e-reader market, right? Like, it's the brand. Like, it's crazy how much they just kind of sit around and do nothing with it.
It's been nearly 5 years since the Oasis was announced.
Right. I don't even think they officially sell it anymore. When I pulled it up on Amazon, it's just used. So you
I can buy a new one today.
Can you buy a new one? Okay, well, in the land of freedom, Daniel, you can't. So
that's interesting, actually. And it's expensive still. It's $330 Canadian dollars for the base one.
When I searched Kindle on Amazon, which I did after I pulled up the Oasis listing, it's just the Paperwhite, the regular $99 Kindle, the signature edition of the Paperwhite, and the Scribe. And then it starts recommending like tablets and stuff like that.
Honestly, the Paperwhite is still a really good product.
Yeah.
And it's cheap. It works. It has USB-C. I think the Kobo is interesting mainly because there's a lot of customization that you can do. There's more fonts available. There's more ways to tweak the reading experience. I like the backlight. It's really well done. It adjusts according to the time of day if you want it to. There is stylus support with the new one. You still have to pay for it. It's like a $70 stylus, but it's an active stylus, which means that writing is so smooth. It's beautiful. It feels like you're writing on paper, almost as good as like the Remarkable 2. Not that I would choose to write. It's not big enough to do that, but it's a really nice pen. And this is just kind of the Oasis replacement that I've been waiting for. I think I've written and or commissioned I want a Kindle Oasis replacement like 5 times in the last few years, because I hate the fact that it charges via micro USB. I don't like a lot of the Kindle's ecosystem limitations. Kobo just makes it, it's more open. It supports more open source e-reader formats. This OverDrive integration is incredible. So yeah, I'm enamored of it. A lot of the reviews, the early reviews are pretty enamored. And yeah, I'd recommend it. The Clara color is cheaper. It's smaller. It doesn't have the pen support, but it's the same display. So if you're not really into the bigger screen ergonomic buttons, you just want like a straightforward color e-reader. The only thing there is, why would you buy a color e-reader if you're not going to use the color really? Because like for me, I would use this for like graphic novels and other things that really take advantage of the bigger screen. But
well, they have the new, so the, yeah, I mean the, I guess the argument would be that the new black and white version of the Clara is only $20 cheaper, so you're really not saving any money. Like you're saving a little bit of money, but you're saving like the cost of one book, one ebook basically, by not getting the color model. And so why not just upgrade to that one? It is interesting that the Clara color is the same price as the Kindle Paperwhite. If you're not locked into Kindle and you do any amount of like, I'm not seeing a huge reason other than your argument about sideloaded content, Daniel. Like, man, I'm not seeing a lot of reason to get the Paperwhite over the Clara color.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just about like ecosystem. Do you have a lot of books already tied up in it?
And people do. And that's probably why Amazon is happy to sit on its laurels, but it always comes back to the ecosystem.
Yeah. That being said, like, it's not difficult to export your Kindle books if you know how to.
No, it's not. So.
Okay. That's was that the last thing? Oh, you wanted to talk about the new Vampire Weekend album.
We wanted to talk about the new Vampire Weekend album, Dan.
Well, I want to hear, I've been talking like 80% of this podcast, so I want to hear your thoughts on the new Vampire Weekend album.
Yeah, Vampire Weekend is a band I've always really liked. I know people are hit or miss on their fourth album, which apparently is, they're now saying, was an Ezra solo album. This is like the narrative they're pushing in like interviews, that the other, you know, Rostam was already gone, but the other two band members, both Chris's, did not have anything to do with it, like the studio version, which is crazy and was definitely not how they sold that album 5 years ago. But regardless, Vampire Weekend put out a new album, Only God Was Above Us. And it's like the best album I've heard in at least a year. Like, I'm kind of obsessed with it. I have listened to it at least a dozen times. I went out and bought the vinyl this week, as I was talking about to Daniel in the pre-show. It is some of the best production I've heard on a rock album in I don't know how long. Some of the stuff they're doing just like sonically on it is crazy, especially the first. I like the entire thing, but the first half of the album especially is like, just listen to the first track, Ice Cream Piano. And if you don't get into how that song builds over its 3.5 minute runtime, I don't know. I think anyone can listen to that and be like, okay, I get it. Like it's just a fucking killer album, man.
It's so good. It is so, so good.
It's all I'm going to, not all I'm going to listen to on the way to Montreal next week, but it is, it's definitely part of it. It has been, when I'm not listening to it, it has been the only thing that has been stuck in my head. Like I can hear like half of these songs right now. They're so catchy. And I've been reviewing a speaker, which has been great because it just means that like it's just another excuse to listen to this album. So, which I not this episode, we've gone long, but at some point I will rant once again about how bad Spotify's audio quality is. I genuinely switched to listening to this album on Apple Music because it sounds better.
Just on that note, The Verge had a leak of the upcoming Sonos app update.
Yes.
And I am extremely excited about this because obviously there's a rumored headphone release at some point soon, but I hate using the Sonos app. The S2 app is just, it looks nicer, but it just does not work. So the fact that Sonos is finally taking its app experience seriously makes me happy. But yeah, this album is beautiful. It is lush and complex and so good. And like, I loved Father of the Bride.
I did too, but I know it's got its haters. So
I, you know, it's interesting because I liked Contra a lot. I thought Contra was one of the best like late 2000s indie albums. I did not like Modern Vampires of the City. I thought
you
it was
like Modern Vampires.
I
really?
Liked it, but it was, I thought it was too twee. I thought it was like very, I don't know, self-referential.
That's
I don't know. It wasn't my favorite. I love Father of Bride. It felt they had a lot of guests on that album, which I thought made it better. Like Haim.
The kick drums on Sympathy fucking always get me. When that kicks in near the end, when it's got the double pedal on the drum, like the song goes hard. But that whole album, like, it's long, but I think there's a lot of good shit on that album.
Yeah.
This one though, I mean, to your point, I think Vampire Weekend has always been kind of a twee band, right? They're like the Wes Anderson of indie music. Oof,
I wouldn't go that far.
It's maybe not that far, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
No, I think they kind of escaped the twee stuff that people maybe didn't vibe with on this new album, without losing what made their music special to me to begin with. I have no idea what they're doing on Connect, which is the fourth song on the album, but I love it. The way that the piano sounds on that song is insane.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
That's all. I just wanted to shout it out because I love it so much and I want more people to listen to it. I really think it might be in the running. It's I can't imagine an album beating this for my favorite album of the year. When we circle back in December, Daniel, to talk about what we loved in 2024, this will be on the list.
I look forward to it. It's one of my favorite recordings of every year, going through our top pieces of culture
media. Yeah. Speaking of, we should say, assuming scheduling goes right, we are going to record next week in person.
Correct. We are going to record in person. I'll meet you in person for the first time.
Yeah, we're like a few days away from that. It'll be Monday.
I'm excited.
I am excited too. It's a long time coming. Every single time I drive by Toronto, which is often enough, I'm always like, I've never met Daniel. I always think that. I'm like, he's right there. Oh well.
You're goodbye. Always waving, like, to me from the 401.
No. I'm bougie enough to take the 407.
Oh, sorry, you're right.
local road talk. Yeah, I've done my time on the 401.
We're gonna end it there. I want to say thank you to everybody who emailed congratulating us for our 100th episode. It was very gratifying. Thank you. I also got a really good tip. I complained about the sharing stuff last week on Google Photos and how difficult it is to download shared photos. And somebody emailed me a really good tip that if you're having that problem, just favorite the images. They show up in your library under favorites, and then you can easily download them.
That's smart.
It's just a UX black hole that I don't understand, but there you go. That's a solution to it. Thank you very much. I appreciate you sending
it. I also want to really quickly shout out, I wrote about taking photos of the eclipse this week. We didn't talk about the eclipse.
Oh, yeah. That happened on Monday. I love the eclipse. It was great.
I took photos of it with the Pixel 8 Pro. I didn't do anything special with it. I just snapped photos with the Pixel 8 Pro. It was very cloudy here. It was very cloudy most places, so it wasn't just us. But I had people either comment on that piece or write in to me to share their own photos, and I thought that was really cool. If you have photos, you're listening to this, send them to us. I would love to see them. But yeah, I wrote a piece about how nice it is to take good enough photos of the eclipse that are yours, and even if photos in 20 years, the next time an eclipse happens in the US will be much, much better, right? Like cameras on whatever we're using as phones those days will be much better. There's something special about taking what may or may not be considered a bad photo that is yours of a shared event. So go read that piece.
I will see you in a few days, Will, and we will talk to you all in a few days as well. Until then, have a great week, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In 2077, what makes someone a criminal? Getting caught.